Chapter 17, Speedboat to Polynesia. Pacific Island history is encapsulated for me in an incident that happened when three Indonesian friends and I walked into a store in Jayapura, the capital of Indonesian New Guinea. My friends' names were Ahmad, Wiwar, and Sawakari, and the store was run by a merchant named Pingwa. Ahmad, an Indonesian government officer, was acting as the boss, because he and I were organizing an ecological survey for the government and had hired Wiwar and Sawakari as local assistants. But Ahmad had never before been in a New Guinea mountain forest and had no idea what supplies to buy. The results were comical. At the moment that my friends entered the store, Pingwa was reading a Chinese newspaper. When he saw Wiwar and Sawakari, he kept reading it, but then shoved it out of sight under the counter as soon as he noticed Ahmad. Ahmad picked up an axe head, causing Wiwar and Sawakari to laugh, because he was holding it upside down. Wiwar and Sawakari showed him how to hold it correctly and to test it. Ahmad and Sawakari then looked at Wiwar's bare feet, with toes splayed wide from a lifetime of not wearing shoes. Sawakari picked out the widest available shoes and held them against Wiwar's feet, but the shoes were still too narrow, sending Ahmad and Sawakari and Ping Hua into peals of laughter. Ahmad picked up a plastic comb with which to comb out his straight, coarse black hair. Glancing at Wiwar's tough, tightly coiled hair, he handed the comb to Wiwar. It immediately stuck in Wiwar's hair, then broke as soon as Wiwar pulled on the comb. Everyone laughed, including Wiwar. Wiwar responded by reminding Ahmad that he should buy lots of rice, because there would be no food to buy in New Guinea mountain villages except sweet potatoes, which would upset Ahmad's stomach. More hilarity. Despite all the laughter, I could sense the underlying tensions. Ahmad was Javan, Pingwa Chinese, Wiwar a New Guinea Highlander, and Sawakari a New Guinea lowlander from the north coast. Javans dominate the Indonesian government, which annexed western New Guinea in the 1960s, and used bombs and machine guns to crush New Guinean opposition. Ahmad later decided to stay in town and to let me do the forest survey alone with Wiwar and Sawakari. He explained his decision to me by pointing to his straight, coarse hair, so unlike that of New Guineans, and saying that New Guineans would kill anyone with hair like his if they found him far from army backup. Pingwa had put away his newspaper because importation of Chinese writing is nominally illegal in Indonesian New Guinea. In much of Indonesia, the merchants are Chinese immigrants. Latent mutual fear between the economically dominant Chinese and politically dominant Javans erupted in 1966 in a bloody revolution when Javans slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Chinese. As New Guineans, Wiwar and Sawakari shared most New Guineans' resentment of Javan dictatorship, but they also scorned each other's groups. Highlanders dismiss lowlanders as effete sago-eaters, while lowlanders dismiss highlanders as primitive big-heads, referring both to their massive coiled hair and to their reputation for arrogance. Within a few days of my setting up an isolated forest camp with Wiwar and Sawakari, they came close to fighting each other with axes. Tensions among the groups that Ahmad, Wiwar, Sawakari, and Pingwa represent dominate the politics of Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous nation. These modern tensions have roots going back thousands of years. When we think of major overseas population movements, we tend to focus on those since Columbus's discovery of the Americas and on the resulting replacements of non-Europeans by Europeans within historic times. But there were also big overseas movements long before Columbus, and prehistoric replacements of non-European peoples by other non-European peoples. Wiwar, Ahmad, and Sawakari represent three prehistorical waves of people that moved overseas from the Asian mainland into the Pacific. Wiwar's Highlanders are probably descended from an early wave that had colonized New Guinea from Asia by 40,000 years ago. Ahmad's ancestors arrived in Java, ultimately from the South China coast, around 4,000 years ago, completing the replacement there of people related to Wiwar's ancestors. Sawakari's ancestors reached New Guinea around 3,600 years ago as part of that same wave from the South China coast, while Pingwa's ancestors still occupy China. The population movement that brought Achmad's and Sawakari's ancestors to Java and New Guinea, respectively, termed the Austronesian expansion, was among the biggest population movements of the last 6,000 years. One prong of it became the Polynesians, who populated the most remote islands of the Pacific and were the greatest seafarers among Neolithic peoples. Austronesian languages are spoken today as native languages over more than half of the globe's span, from Madagascar to Easter Island. In this book on human population movements since the end of the Ice Ages, the Austronesian expansion occupies a central place as one of the most important phenomena to be explained. Why did Austronesian people, stemming ultimately from mainland China, colonize Java and the rest of Indonesia, and replace the original inhabitants there, instead of Indonesians colonizing China and replacing the Chinese? Having occupied all of Indonesia, why were the Austronesians then unable to occupy more than a narrow coastal strip of the New Guinea lowlands, and why were they completely unable to displace Wiwar's people from the New Guinea highlands? How did the descendants of Chinese immigrants become transformed into Polynesians? Today, the population of Java, most other Indonesian islands except the easternmost ones, and the Philippines is rather homogeneous. In appearance and genes, those islands' inhabitants are similar to South Chinese, and even more similar to tropical Southeast Asians, especially those of the Malay Peninsula. Their languages are equally homogeneous. While 374 languages are spoken in the Philippines and Western and Central Indonesia, all of them are closely related and fall within the same sub-subfamily, Western Malayo-Polynesian, of the Austronesian language family. Austronesian languages reached the Asian mainland on the Malay Peninsula and in small pockets in Vietnam and Cambodia, near the westernmost Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. But they occur nowhere else on the mainland. Some Austronesian words borrowed into English include taboo and tattoo from a Polynesian language, boondocks from the Tagalog language of the Philippines, and amuk, batik, and orangutan from Malay. That genetic and linguistic uniformity of Indonesia and the Philippines is initially as surprising as is the predominant linguistic uniformity of China. The famous Java Homo erectus fossils prove that humans have occupied at least Western Indonesia for a million years. That should have given ample time for humans to evolve genetic and linguistic diversity and tropical adaptations, such as dark skins like those of many other tropical peoples. But instead, Indonesians and Filipinos have light skins. It is also surprising that Indonesians and Filipinos are so similar to tropical Southeast Asians and South Chinese in other physical features besides light skins and in their genes. A glance at a map makes it obvious that Indonesia offered the only possible route by which humans could have reached New Guinea and Australia 40,000 years ago. So one might naively have expected modern Indonesians to be like modern New Guineans and Australians. In reality, there are only a few New Guinean-like populations in the Philippine Western Indonesia area, notably the Negritos living in mountainous areas of the Philippines. As is also true of the three New Guinean-like relict populations that I mentioned in speaking of tropical Southeast Asia, the Philippine Negritos could be relics of populations ancestral to Wiwar's people before they reached New Guinea. Even those Negritos speak Austronesian languages similar to those of their Filipino neighbors, implying that they too, like Malaysia's Semang Negritos and Africa's Pygmies, have lost their original language. All these facts suggest strongly that either tropical Southeast Asians or South Chinese speaking Austronesian languages recently spread through the Philippines and Indonesia, replacing all the former inhabitants of those islands except the Philippine Negritos, and replacing all the original island languages. That event evidently took place too recently for the colonists to evolve dark skins, distinct language families, or genetic distinctiveness or diversity. Their languages are, of course, much more numerous than the eight dominant Chinese languages of mainland China, but are no more diverse. The proliferation of many similar languages in the Philippines and Indonesia merely reflects the fact that the islands never underwent a political and cultural unification, as did China. Details of language distributions provide valuable clues to the root of this hypothesized Austronesian expansion. The whole Austronesian language family consists of 959 languages, divided among four subfamilies. But one of those subfamilies, termed Malayo-Polynesian, comprises 945 of those 959 languages and covers almost the entire geographic range of the Austronesian family. Before the recent overseas expansion of Europeans speaking Indo-European languages, Austronesian was the most widespread language family in the world. That suggests that the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily differentiated recently out of the Austronesian family and spread far from the Austronesian homeland, giving rise to many local languages, all of which are still closely related because there has been too little time to develop large linguistic differences. For the location of that Austronesian homeland, we should therefore look not to Malayo-Polynesian, but to the other three Austronesian subfamilies, which differ considerably more from each other and from Malayo-Polynesian than the sub-subfamilies of Malayo-Polynesian differ among each other. It turns out that those three other subfamilies have coincident distributions, all of them tiny compared with the distribution of Malayo-Polynesian. They are confined to aborigines of the island of Taiwan, lying only 90 miles from the South China mainland. Taiwan's aborigines had the island largely to themselves until mainland Chinese began settling in large numbers within the last 1,000 years. Still more mainlanders arrived after 1945, especially after the Chinese communists defeated the Chinese nationalists in 1949, so that aborigines now constitute only 2% of Taiwan's population. The concentration of three out of the four Austronesian subfamilies on Taiwan suggests that, within the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan is the homeland where Austronesian languages have been spoken for the most millennia and have consequently had the longest time in which to diverge. All other Austronesian languages, from those on Madagascar to those on Easter Island, would then stem from a population expansion out of Taiwan. We can now turn to archaeological evidence. While the debris of ancient village sites does not include fossilized words along with bones and pottery, it does reveal movements of people and cultural artifacts that could be associated with languages. Like the rest of the world, most of the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan, the Philippines, Indonesia, and many Pacific islands, was originally occupied by hunter-gatherers, lacking pottery, polished stone tools, domestic animals, and crops. The sole exceptions to this generalization are the remote islands of Madagascar, eastern Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia, which were never reached by hunter-gatherers and remained empty of humans until the Austronesian expansion. The first archaeological signs of something different within the Austronesian realm come from Taiwan. Beginning around the 4th millennium BC, polished stone tools and a distinctive decorated pottery style, so-called Tapen King pottery, derived from earlier South China mainland pottery, appeared on Taiwan and on the opposite coast of the South China mainland. Remains of rice and millet at later Taiwanese sites provide evidence of agriculture. Tapen King sites of Taiwan and the South China coast are full of fish bones and mollusk shells, as well as of stone net sinkers and adzes suitable for hollowing out a wooden canoe. Evidently, those first Neolithic occupants of Taiwan had watercraft adequate for deep-sea fishing and for regular sea traffic across Taiwan Strait, separating that island from the China coast. Thus, Taiwan Strait may have served as the training ground where mainland Chinese developed the open-water maritime skills that would permit them to expand over the Pacific. One specific type of artifact linking Taiwan's Tapen King culture to later Pacific Island cultures is a bark beater, a stone implement used for pounding the fibrous bark of certain tree species into rope, nets, and clothing. Once Pacific peoples spread beyond the range of wool-yielding domestic animals and fiber plant crops and hence of woven clothing, they became dependent on pounded bark cloth for their clothing. Inhabitants of Rennell Island, a traditional Polynesian island that did not become westernized until the 1930s, told me that westernization yielded the wonderful side benefit that the island became quiet. No more sounds of bark beaters everywhere, pounding out bark cloth from dawn until after dusk every day. Within a millennium or so after the Taiping King culture reached Taiwan, archaeological evidence shows that cultures obviously derived from it spread farther and farther from Taiwan to fill up the modern Austronesian realm. The evidence includes ground stone tools, pottery, bones of domestic pigs, and crop remains. For example, the decorated Taiping King pottery on Taiwan gave way to undecorated plain or red pottery, which has also been found at sites in the Philippines and on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and Timor. This cultural package of pottery, stone tools, and domesticates appeared around 3000 BC in the Philippines, around 2500 BC on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and North Borneo and Timor, around 2000 BC on Java and Sumatra, and around 1600 BC in the New Guinea region. There, as we shall see, the expansion assumed a speedboat pace as bearers of the cultural package raced eastward into the previously uninhabited Pacific Ocean beyond the Solomon Archipelago. The last phases of the expansion during the millennium after AD 1 resulted in the colonization of every Polynesian and Micronesian island capable of supporting humans. Astonishingly, it also swept westward across the Indian Ocean to the east coast of Africa, resulting in the colonization of the island of Madagascar. At least until the expansion reached coastal New Guinea, travel between islands was probably by double outrigger sailing canoes, which are still widespread throughout Indonesia today. That boat design represented a major advance over the simple dugout canoes prevalent among traditional peoples living on inland waterways throughout the world. A dugout canoe is just what its name implies, a solid tree trunk dug out, that is, hollowed out, and its ends shaped by an adze. Since the canoe is as round-bottomed as the trunk from which it was carved, the least imbalance in weight distribution tips the canoe toward the overweighted side. Whenever I've been paddled in dugouts up New Guinea rivers by New Guineans, I have spent much of the trip in terror. It seems that every slight movement of mine risked capsizing the canoe and spilling out me and my binoculars to commune with crocodiles. New Guineans manage to look secure while paddling dugouts on calm lakes and rivers, but not even New Guineans can use a dugout in seas with modest waves. Hence, some stabilizing device must have been essential not only for the Austronesian expansion through Indonesia, but even for the initial colonization of Taiwan. The solution was to lash two smaller logs, outriggers, parallel to the hull and several feet from it, one on each side, connected to the hull by poles lashed perpendicular to the hull and outriggers. Whenever the hull starts to tip toward one side, the buoyancy of the outrigger on that side prevents the outrigger from being pushed under the water, and hence makes it virtually impossible to capsize the vessel. The invention of the double outrigger sailing canoe may have been the technological breakthrough that triggered the Austronesian expansion from the Chinese mainland. Two striking coincidences between archaeological and linguistic evidence support the inference that the people bringing a Neolithic culture to Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia thousands of years ago spoke Austronesian languages and were ancestral to the Austronesian speakers still inhabiting those islands today. First, both types of evidence point unequivocally to the colonization of Taiwan as the first stage of the expansion from the South China coast, and to the colonization of the Philippines and Indonesia from Taiwan as the next stage. If the expansion had proceeded from tropical Southeast Asia's Malay Peninsula to the nearest Indonesian island of Sumatra, then to other Indonesian islands, and finally to the Philippines and Taiwan, we would find the deepest divisions, reflecting the greatest time depth, of the Austronesian language family among the modern languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra, and the languages of Taiwan and the Philippines would have differentiated only recently within a single subfamily. Instead, the deepest divisions are in Taiwan, and the languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra fall together in the same sub-sub-subfamily, a recent branch of the Western Malayo-Polynesian sub-subfamily, which is in turn a fairly recent branch of the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily. Those details of linguistic relationships agree perfectly with the archaeological evidence that the colonization of the Malay Peninsula was recent and followed rather than preceded the colonization of Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. The other coincidence between archaeological and linguistic evidence concerns the cultural baggage that ancient Austronesians used. Archaeology provides us with direct evidence of culture in the form of pottery, pig and fish bones, and so on. One might initially wonder how a linguist, studying only modern languages whose unwritten ancestral forms remain unknown, could ever figure out whether Austronesians living on Taiwan 6,000 years ago had pigs. The solution is to reconstruct the vocabularies of vanished ancient languages, so-called proto-languages, by comparing vocabularies of modern languages derived from them. For instance, the words meaning sheep in many languages of the Indo-European language family distributed from Ireland to India are quite similar. Avis, avis, ovis, oveja, ovca, ovis, and oi in Lithuanian, Sanskrit, Latin, Spanish, Russian, Greek, and Irish, respectively. The English sheep is obviously from a different root, but English retains the original root in the word ewe. Comparison of the sound shifts that the various modern Indo-European languages have undergone during their histories suggests that the original form was ois in the ancestral Indo-European language spoken around 6,000 years ago. That unwritten ancestral language is termed Proto-Indo-European. Evidently, Proto-Indo-Europeans 6,000 years ago had sheep in agreement with archaeological evidence. Nearly 2,000 other words of their vocabulary can similarly be reconstructed, including words for goat, horse, wheel, brother, and eye. But no Proto-Indo-European word can be reconstructed for gun, which uses different roots in different modern Indo-European languages, gun in English, fusil in French, rougeau in Russian, and so on. That shouldn't surprise us. People 6,000 years ago couldn't possibly have had a word for guns, which were invented only within the past 1,000 years. Since there was thus no inherited shared root meaning gun, each Indo-European language had to invent or borrow its own word when guns were finally invented. Proceeding in the same way, we can compare modern Taiwanese, Philippine, Indonesian, and Polynesian languages to reconstruct a Proto-Austronesian language spoken in the distant past. To no one's surprise, that reconstructed Proto-Austronesian language had words with meanings such as two, bird, ear, and head louse. Of course, Proto-Austronesians could count to two, knew of birds, and had ears and lice. More interestingly, the reconstructed language had words for pig, dog, and rice, which must therefore have been part of Proto-Austronesian culture. The reconstructed language is full of words indicating a maritime economy, such as outrigger canoe, sail, giant clam, octopus, fish trap, and sea turtle. This linguistic evidence regarding the culture of Proto-Austronesians, wherever and whenever they lived, agrees well with the archaeological evidence regarding the pottery-making, sea-oriented, food-producing people living on Taiwan around 6,000 years ago. The same procedure can be applied to reconstruct Proto-Malayo-Polynesian, the ancestral language spoken by Austronesians after emigrating from Taiwan. Proto-Malayo-Polynesian contains words for many tropical crops like taro, breadfruit, bananas, yams, and coconuts, for which no word can be reconstructed in Proto-Austronesian. Thus, the linguistic evidence suggests that many tropical crops were added to the Austronesian repertoire after the emigration from Taiwan. This conclusion agrees with archaeological evidence, as colonizing farmers spread southward from Taiwan, lying about 23 degrees north of the equator, toward the equatorial tropics. They came to depend increasingly on tropical root and tree crops, which they proceeded to carry with them out into the tropical Pacific. How could those Austronesian-speaking farmers from South China via Taiwan replace the original hunter-gatherer population of the Philippines and western Indonesia so completely that little genetic and no linguistic evidence of that original population survived? The reasons resemble the reasons why Europeans replaced or exterminated native Australians within the last two centuries, and why South Chinese replaced the original tropical Southeast Asians earlier. The farmers' much denser populations, superior tools and weapons, more developed watercraft and maritime skills, and epidemic diseases to which the farmers but not the hunter-gatherers had some resistance. On the Asian mainland, Austronesian-speaking farmers were able similarly to replace some of the former hunter-gatherers of the Malay Peninsula, because Austronesians colonized the peninsula from the south and east, from the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo, around the same time that Austroasiatic-speaking farmers were colonizing the peninsula from the north, from Thailand. Other Austronesians managed to establish themselves in parts of southern Vietnam and Cambodia to become the ancestors of the modern Chamic minority of those countries. However, Austronesian farmers could spread no farther into the Southeast Asian mainland because Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai farmers had already replaced the former hunter-gatherers there, and because Austronesian farmers had no advantage over Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai farmers. Although we infer that Austronesian speakers originated from coastal South China, Austronesian languages today are not spoken anywhere in mainland China, possibly because they were among the hundreds of former Chinese languages eliminated by the southward expansion of Sino-Tibetan speakers. But the language families closest to Austronesian are thought to be Thai Kadai, Austroasiatic, and Miao Yao. Thus, while Austronesian languages in China may not have survived the onslaught of Chinese dynasties, some of their sister and cousin languages did. We have now followed the initial stages of the Austronesian expansion for 2,500 miles from the South China coast through Taiwan and the Philippines to western and central Indonesia. In the course of that expansion, Austronesians came to occupy all habitable areas of those islands, from the seacoast to the interior, and from the lowlands to the mountains. By 1500 BC, their familiar archaeological hallmarks, including pig bones and plain red-slipped pottery, show that they had reached the eastern Indonesian island of Halmahera, less than 200 miles from the western end of the big mountainous island of New Guinea. Did they proceed to overrun that island, just as they had already overrun the big mountainous islands of Celebes, Borneo, Java, and Sumatra? They did not, as a glance at the faces of most modern New Guineans makes obvious, and as detailed studies of New Guinean genes confirm. My friend Wewar and all other New Guinea Highlanders differ obviously from Indonesians, Filipinos, and South Chinese in their dark skins, tightly coiled hair, and face shapes. Most lowlanders from New Guinea's interior and south coast resemble the Highlanders except that they tend to be taller. Geneticists have failed to find characteristic Austronesian gene markers in blood samples from New Guinea Highlanders. But peoples of New Guinea's north and east coasts and of the Bismarck and Solomon archipelagos north and south of New Guinea present a more complex picture. In appearance, they are variably intermediate between Highlanders like Wewar and Indonesians like Akmad, though on the average considerably closer to Wewar. For instance, my friend Sawakari from the north coast has wavy hair intermediate between Akmad's straight hair and Wewar's coiled hair, and skin somewhat paler than Wewar's, though considerably darker than Akmad's. Genetically, the Bismarck and Solomon Islanders and north coastal New Guineans are about 15% Austronesian and 85% like New Guinea Highlanders. Hence, Austronesians evidently reached the New Guinea region but failed completely to penetrate the island's interior and were genetically diluted by New Guinea's previous residents on the north coast and islands. Modern languages tell essentially the same story but add detail. In Chapter 15, I explained that most New Guinea languages, termed Papuan languages, are unrelated to any language families elsewhere in the world. Without exception, every language spoken in the New Guinea mountains, the whole of southwestern and south-central lowland New Guinea, including the coast, and the interior of northern New Guinea, is a Papuan language. But Austronesian languages are spoken in a narrow strip immediately on the north and southeast coasts. Most languages of the Bismarck and Solomon Islands are Austronesian. Papuan languages are spoken only in isolated pockets on a few islands. Austronesian languages spoken in the Bismarcks and Solomons and north coastal New Guinea are related, as a separate sub-sub-subfamily termed Oceanic, to the sub-sub-subfamily of languages spoken on Halmahera and the west end of New Guinea. That linguistic relationship confirms, as one would expect from a map, that Austronesian speakers of the New Guinea region arrived by way of Halmahera. Details of Austronesian and Papuan languages and their distributions in north New Guinea testify to long contact between the Austronesian invaders and the Papuan-speaking residents. Both the Austronesian and the Papuan languages of the region show massive influences of each other's vocabularies and grammars, making it difficult to decide whether certain languages are basically Austronesian languages influenced by Papuan ones, or the reverse. As one travels from village to village along the north coast or its fringing islands, one passes from a village with an Austronesian language to a village with a Papuan language, and then to another Austronesian-speaking language, without any genetic discontinuity at the linguistic boundaries. All this suggests that descendants of Austronesian invaders and of original New Guineans have been trading, intermarrying, and acquiring each other's genes and languages for several thousand years on the North New Guinea coast and its islands. That long contact transferred Austronesian languages more effectively than Austronesian genes, with the result that most Bismarck and Solomon Islanders now speak Austronesian languages, even though their appearance and most of their genes are still Papuan. But neither the genes nor the languages of the Austronesians penetrated New Guinea's interior. The outcome of their invasion of New Guinea was thus very different from the outcome of their invasion of Borneo, Celebes, and other big Indonesian islands, where their steamroller eliminated almost all traces of the previous inhabitants' genes and languages. To understand what happened in New Guinea, let us now turn to the evidence from archaeology. Around 1600 BC, almost simultaneously with their appearance on Halmahera, the familiar archaeological hallmarks of the Austronesian expansion, pigs, chickens, dogs, red-slipped pottery, and adzes of ground stone, and of giant clamshells, appear in the New Guinea region. But two features distinguish the Austronesians' arrival there from their earlier arrival in the Philippines and Indonesia. The first feature consists of pottery designs, which are aesthetic features of no economic significance, but which do let archaeologists immediately recognize an early Austronesian site. Whereas most early Austronesian pottery in the Philippines and Indonesia was undecorated, pottery in the New Guinea region was finely decorated with geometric designs arranged in horizontal bands. In other respects, the pottery preserved the red slip and the vessel forms characteristic of earlier Austronesian pottery in Indonesia. Evidently, Austronesian settlers in the New Guinea region got the idea of tattooing their pots, perhaps inspired by geometric designs that they had already been using on their bark cloth and body tattoos. This style is termed Lapita pottery, after an archaeological site named Lapita, where it was described. The much more significant distinguishing feature of early Austronesian sites in the New Guinea region is their distribution. In contrast to those in the Philippines and Indonesia, where even the earliest known Austronesian sites are on big islands like Luzon and Borneo and Celebes, sites with Lapita pottery in the New Guinea region are virtually confined to small islets fringing remote larger islands. To date, Lapita pottery has been found at only one site, Aitape, on the north coast of New Guinea itself, and at a couple of sites in the Solomons. Most Lapita sites of the New Guinea region are in the Bismarcks, on islets off the coast of the larger Bismarck Islands, occasionally on the coasts of the larger islands themselves. Since, as we shall see, the makers of Lapita pottery were capable of sailing thousands of miles, their failure to transfer their villages a few miles to the large Bismarck Islands or a few dozen miles to New Guinea was certainly not due to inability to get there. The basis of Lapita subsistence can be reconstructed from the garbage excavated by archaeologists at Lapita sites. Lapita people depended heavily on seafood, including fish, porpoises, sea turtles, sharks, and shellfish. They had pigs, chickens, and dogs, and ate the nuts of many trees, including coconuts. While they probably also ate the usual Austronesian root crops, such as taro and yams, evidence of those crops is hard to obtain, because hard nut shells are much more likely than soft roots to persist for thousands of years in garbage heaps. Naturally, it is impossible to prove directly that the people who made Lapita pots spoke an Austronesian language. However, two facts make this inference virtually certain. First, except for the decorations on the pots themselves and their associated cultural paraphernalia are similar to the cultural remains found at Indonesian and Philippine sites ancestral to modern Austronesian-speaking societies. Second, Lapita pottery also appears on remote Pacific islands with no previous human inhabitants, with no evidence of a major second wave of settlement subsequent to that bringing Lapita pots, and where the modern inhabitants speak an Austronesian language. Hence, Lapita pottery may be safely assumed to mark Austronesians' arrival in the New Guinea region. What were those Austronesian potmakers doing on islets adjacent to bigger islands? They were probably living in the same way as modern potmakers lived until recently on islets in the New Guinea region. In 1972, I visited such a village on Malai Islet, in the Siassi Island group off the medium-sized island of Umboy, off the larger Bismarck Island of New Britain. When I stepped ashore on Malai in search of birds, knowing nothing about the people there, I was astonished by the sight that greeted me. Instead of the usual village of low huts surrounded by large gardens sufficient to feed the village and with a few canoes drawn up on the beach, most of the area of Malai was occupied by two-story wooden houses side by side, leaving no ground available for gardens, the New Guinea equivalent of downtown Manhattan. On the beach were rows of big canoes. It turned out that Malai Islanders, besides being fishermen, were also specialized potters, carvers, and traders who lived by making beautifully decorated pots and wooden bowls, transporting them in their canoes to larger islands and exchanging their wares for pigs, dogs, vegetables, and other necessities. Even the timber for Malai canoes was obtained by trade from villagers on nearby Umboy Island, since Malai does not have trees big enough to be fashioned into canoes. In the days before European shipping, trade between islands in the New Guinea region was monopolized by such specialized groups of canoe-building potters skilled in sailing without navigational instruments, and living on offshore islets or occasionally in mainland coastal villages. By the time I reached Malai in 1972, those indigenous trade networks had collapsed or contracted, partly because of competition from European motor vessels and aluminum pots, partly because the Australian colonial government forbade long-distance canoe voyaging after some accidents in which traders were drowned. I would guess that the Lapita potters were the inter-island traders of the New Guinea region in the centuries after 1600 BC. The spread of Austronesian languages to the north coast of New Guinea itself, and over even the largest Bismarck and Solomon Islands, must have occurred mostly after Lapita times, since Lapita sites themselves were concentrated on Bismarck Islets. Not until around AD 1 did pottery derived from the Lapita style appear on the south side of New Guinea's southeast peninsula. When Europeans began exploring New Guinea in the late 19th century, all the remainder of New Guinea's south coast still supported populations only of Papuan language speakers, even though Austronesian-speaking populations were established not only on the southeastern peninsula, but also on the Aru and Kei Islands, lying 70 to 80 miles off western New Guinea's south coast. Austronesians thus had thousands of years in which to colonize New Guinea's interior and its southern coast from nearby bases, but they never did so. Even their colonization of North New Guinea's coastal fringe was more linguistic than genetic. All northern coastal peoples remained predominantly New Guineans in their genes. At most, some of the merely adopted Austronesian languages, possibly in order to communicate with the long-distance traders who linked societies. Thus, the outcome of the Austronesian expansion in the New Guinea region was opposite to that in Indonesia and the Philippines. In the latter region, the indigenous population disappeared, presumably driven off, killed, infected, or assimilated by the invaders. In the former region, the indigenous population mostly kept the invaders out. The invaders, the Austronesians, were the same in both cases, and the indigenous populations may also have been genetically similar to each other. If the original Indonesian population supplanted by Austronesians really was related to New Guineans, as I suggested earlier, why the opposite outcomes? The answer becomes obvious when one considers the differing cultural circumstances of Indonesia's and New Guinea's indigenous populations. Before Austronesians arrived, most of Indonesia was thinly occupied by hunter-gatherers lacking even polished stone tools. In contrast, Food production had already been established for thousands of years in the New Guinea highlands, and probably in the New Guinea lowlands and in the Bismarcks and Solomons as well. The New Guinea highlands supported some of the densest populations of Stone Age people anywhere in the modern world. Austronesians enjoyed few advantages in competing with those established New Guinean populations. Some of the crops on which Austronesians subsisted, such as taro, yams, and bananas, had probably already been independently domesticated in New Guinea before Austronesians arrived. The New Guineans readily integrated Austronesian chickens, dogs, and especially pigs into their food-producing economies. New Guineans already had polished stone tools. They were at least as resistant to tropical diseases as were Austronesians because they carried the same five types of genetic protections against malaria as did Austronesians, and some or all of those genes evolved independently in New Guinea. New Guineans were already accomplished seafarers, although not as accomplished as the makers of Lapita pottery. Tens of thousands of years before the arrival of Austronesians, New Guineans had colonized the Bismarck and Solomon archipelagos, and a trade in obsidian, a volcanic stone suitable for making sharp tools, was thriving in the Bismarcks at least 18,000 years before the Austronesians arrived. New Guineans even seem to have expanded recently westward against the Austronesian tide into eastern Indonesia, where languages spoken on the islands of North Halmahera and of Timor are typical Papuan languages related to some languages of western New Guinea. In short, the variable outcomes of the Austronesian expansion strikingly illustrate the role of food production in human population movements. Austronesian food producers migrated into two regions, New Guinea and Indonesia, occupied by resident peoples who were probably related to each other. The residents of Indonesia were still hunter-gatherers, while the residents of New Guinea were already food producers and had developed many of the concomitants of food production, dense populations, disease resistance, more advanced technology, and so on. As a result, while the Austronesian expansion swept away the original Indonesians, it failed to make much headway in the New Guinea region, just as it also failed to make headway against Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai food producers in tropical Southeast Asia. We have now traced the Austronesian expansion through Indonesia and up to the shores of New Guinea and tropical Southeast Asia. In Chapter 19, we shall trace it across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar, while in Chapter 15, we saw that ecological difficulties kept Austronesians from establishing themselves in northern and western Australia. The expansion's remaining thrust began when the Lapita potters sailed far eastward into the Pacific beyond the Solomons, into an island realm that no other humans had reached previously. Around 1200 BC, Lapita potsherds, the familiar triumvirate of pigs and chickens and dogs, and the usual other archaeological hallmarks of Austronesians appeared on the Pacific archipelagos of Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, over 1,000 miles east of the Solomons. Early in the Christian era, most of those same hallmarks, with the notable exception of pottery, appeared on the islands of eastern Polynesia, including the Societies and Marquesas. Further long overwater canoe voyages brought settlers north to Hawaii, east to Pitcairn and eastern islands, and southwest to New Zealand. The native inhabitants of most of those islands today are the Polynesians, who thus are the direct descendants of the Lapita potters. They speak Austronesian languages closely related to those of the New Guinea region, and their main crops are the Austronesian package that included taro, yams, bananas, coconuts, and breadfruit. With the occupation of the Chatham Islands off New Zealand around AD 1400, barely a century before European explorers entered the Pacific, the task of exploring the Pacific was finally completed by Asians. Their tradition of exploration, lasting tens of thousands of years, had begun when Wiwar's ancestors spread through Indonesia to New Guinea and Australia. It ended only when it had run out of targets and almost every habitable Pacific island had been occupied. To anyone interested in world history, human societies of East Asia and the Pacific are instructive because they provide so many examples of how environment molds history. Depending on their geographic homeland, East Asian and Pacific peoples differed in their access to domesticable wild plant and animal species and in their connectedness to other peoples. Again and again, people with access to the prerequisites for food production and with a location favoring diffusion of technology from elsewhere replaced peoples lacking these advantages. Again and again, when a single wave of colonists spread out over diverse environments, their descendants developed in separate ways, depending on those environmental differences. For instance, we have seen that South Chinese developed indigenous food production and technology, received writing and still more technology and political structures from North China, and went on to colonize tropical Southeast Asia and Taiwan, largely replacing the former inhabitants of those areas. Within Southeast Asia, among the descendants or relatives of those food-producing South Chinese colonists, the Yumbri in the mountain rainforests of northeastern Thailand and Laos reverted to living as hunter-gatherers, while the Yumbri's close relatives, the Vietnamese, speaking a language in the same sub-subfamily of Austroasiatic as the Yumbri language, remained food producers in the rich Red Delta and established a vast metal-based empire. Similarly, among Austronesian emigrant farmers from Taiwan and Indonesia, the Punan in the rainforests of Borneo were forced to turn back to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, while their relatives living on Java's rich volcanic soils remained food producers, founded a kingdom under the influence of India, adopted writing, and built the great Buddhist monument at Borobudur. The Austronesians, who went on to colonize Polynesia, became isolated from East Asian metallurgy and writing, and hence remained without writing or metal. As we saw in Chapter 2, though, Polynesian political and social organization and economies underwent great diversification in different environments. Within a millennium, East Polynesian colonists had reverted to hunting-gathering on the Chathams while building a proto-state with intensive food production on Hawaii. When Europeans at last arrived, their technological and other advantages enabled them to establish temporary colonial domination over most of tropical Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. However, indigenous germs and food producers prevented Europeans from settling most of this region in significant numbers. Within this area, only New Zealand, New Caledonia, and Hawaii, the largest and most remote islands, lying farthest from the equator and hence in the most nearly temperate Europe-like climates, now support large European populations. Thus, unlike Australia and the Americas, East Asia and most Pacific islands remain occupied by East Asian and Pacific peoples.